Session number 1718, Major Wilfred White, Reel 8.
Mr. White, Reel 8. You mentioned there the officers' toilet. What were the toilet facilities for officers and men?
Well, our loo was just something you sat on over a hole. I can't remember any more detail than that. But it was obvious what you were doing by your posture, of course. There's no secrets. Frequently, you just went there to spend a penny, as we say. And that was one of the joys of being on a reverse slope. Gets a bit different when you can expose yourself for the enemy to see as well.
So presumably the hole was filled in every so often and moved?
Yes, but again, in 2 weeks or so, with the Battle of Alamein being prepared for, that probably was overlooked.
The water ration which you mentioned, certainly up the desert, it was extremely tiny. Was it, obviously you weren't there, but was there sufficient water for your needs in the Alamein line?
If you were careful, the water discipline was incredibly good. It had to be, hadn't it? If you got rid of your ration without doing the necessary things, that was hard luck. But while we were in the Alamein position, there was always water for a brew up. There was always a cupful or a half cupful there for washing and shaving, which were extended to doing your socks and rubbing a handkerchief through, that sort of thing. But what you got into your bottle, you had to really look after it.
Was the ration the same for every man, officer and
other? Oh, I think so, yes. Yes. And I don't know whether it's got anything to do with it, but even now, I drink very little water as water, and I only drink it near the water as in a glass of whiskey. But the point is, watching my grandchildren and my family, they frequently using the tap, the water, the glass of water or a bottle of Pepsi Cola. But I don't know. It's just that I'm getting old and certain things are not working the way they should, but I've never been a big drinker of water.
Was it fresh water?
Fresh water until you got to the Tobruk area, and there it was brackish. I later sort of spent a day or two in that area. I was moving up. No, it was appalling. You could even, even your tea tasted of it. And otherwise, if there was any water, it was good.
You were there a short while before you went almost, well, we went in the action situation. But in that short while, were you able to get a bath other than just the washing yourself out of the little...
No, from the time of leaving the base depot until crossing the start line at Alamein, I only had one bath, and that wasn't a proper bath. It was a bathe in the sea. The battalion moving up to Alamein Station or wherever to make an attack. We were allowed to strip off and dash into the sea for 5-10 minutes, which of course we all did, and that was it. But other than that, no, you portioned your water out and rubbed those parts which needed rubbing with it.
Were there any particular health hazards in the desert?
Yeah, well, yes. The biggest two that I became aware of, other than the Germans inflicted one or two health hazards, was a thing called desert sores. You know, if you scratched yourself, grazed yourself, unless you were pretty hot on getting it cauterized or some sort of antiseptic on, or a bandage, it didn't heal. And it sort of became worse. A small scratch became a deep scratch. Then it became a sort of a gaping wound, eventually, if it wasn't dealt with. That was a special hazard. And the other one, round about the start of the Battle of Alamein, and it got worse during the battle, there was a very heavy infection in my part of the world of, I wouldn't call it hepatitis, but I'd say yellow jaundice, the jaundice, that sort of thing, which of course we blame the Germans for, you know, and the Italians. But they were the two sort of characteristically, yes, there was the usual things, you know.
It seemed jaundice was quite prevalent, and certainly in the early days it appeared that officers got it more than men.
Is that a fact? I wouldn't know how to support that. Sufficient that I wasn't there long enough to catch anything, really.
Were flies a problem?
Oh, there must have been, but not as bad as it got. But yes, certainly there'd be flies. There'd be flies, yes. Of course, now you live in conditions where there's no flies. You never see any flies. But I mean, at home we always used to have a fly paper hanging around, revolting things. So probably I was getting more flies at Philadelphia than I was at Alamein. You know.
What was the desert like in the position you were in?
Well, it was truly a sand. I mean, sand that we all know and see at the seaside, but it could be dug into, so it was sort of dampish, and if it was a special sand, it wasn't the very fine stuff, because you still had sandstorms when the wind from a certain direction got it moving, and was terribly unpleasant and got in your hair and everything. And I wasn't sufficiently absorbent about that sort of thing to be, you know, be perfectly honest. The sand was just sand to me in those days. I know. One of my personal fears is of snakes. I just find them totally revolting, and you know they really do. I'd do anything than go into a room with a snake in it. Do you know what I mean? and Snakes and Submarines, they were two. But I had no incident of ever seeing the snake. You know, the Egyptian desert and the North African coast is a lively place for them. But maybe they had sense and got away from the shell bursts or something. I can remember in hospital we saw one or two of these lizards, you know, crawling about the walls. Chameleons, small. But they didn't worry us. But I was not the sort of soldier who saw the glory of nature around him. You know, a hole was a hole. And out on the flat you were in trouble, really.
You were pretty new to the desert. Did you have any problems with the extremes of heat and cold during the course of 24 hours?
No. The answer, shortly, the only trouble I have had was the one I outlined earlier as a result of the route march I took before I was conditioned to it, and fluid loss became a new word, you know. But
it gets very dark, does it, in the desert at night?
Oh, yes, it does. It certainly does. Some nights there's the moon, of course. But when the basic thing without the moon is really black. I can't remember where it was, but we were moving by truck from some place. I think it must have been Benina, outside of Benghazi, up to the Marath line position. We'd gone to the company vehicle to have our coffee or tea together, whatever it was. It was at night. We'll have our last meal of the day together, more for convenience of serving than any other thing. And when I came to go back, although I was only, say, 10 paces away from where where I was, you know, where my station was, where I'd been put, it took me hours, it seemed to be hours to find it, because absolutely black. He could, the sort of darkness he could feel, which has some advantages, I suppose, at night, but it has a hell of a lot of disadvantages.
It mustn't have been easy moving around in the desert at any time.
No, you had to have a definite mind of what you were going to do and what you wanted to do, and aids for moving during daylight even became important, because the desert is fairly featureless. But so you've got to know the look of a thing from the various angles. And night, of course, where you're expected to go and do some work, put mines down or wire down in a certain area, of course, you had to be dead right. There's no thinking, well, this is a bug. And there was a man in the battalion called the intelligence officer, and he got landed with all those sorts of jobs, you know, making absolutely sure you're dead right. Exception being when you had to go on patrol. And fortunately, the only time, there were two occasions spring to mind, was it was easy to find your way, because I think I went on a bearing, compass bearing, out from our lines to the point I wanted to be. And coming back, I did something which I thought was very clever, although it's the way you do things. Instead of going back on a bearing to lead you directly to the gap you want to find, I laid off so that I went back and hit the wire. And when I hit the wire, I knew I had to turn left, as it were, and go along the wire, and I'd find the gap. And I thought the bloke that told me that was talking a lot of sense. Because what do you do if you take a gap, you take a bearing on a gap, and when you arrive at the right sort of distance, there's nothing there. Do you go left or do you go right? Then I became very proud that I could pick out the pole star, or what would be the pole star, wouldn't it be, yes, of course. And simple navigation. I could never understand the sun compass, which we had on top of, on the front of our trucks. Which, you know, you had to relate your position and the time to the sun, and then, oh golly, it's beyond me. Couldn't do that. But I've never had much opportunity of trying that.
Can we look briefly at the duties of a platoon commander? Starting a day, what would be the first thing that you would do?
Well, normally when we were in the battle situation, the first, you usually had what you call a statue. That's you're waking up and you're ready to fight. You know, your weapons there, alert, observing. At first light, and then it sort of got busier, or depending on the day, what was going to happen. The first thing was to get the weapons really cleaned and checked.
And then did you move around the positions yourself?
Yes, quite.
And
definitely.
You could do this because you're on this reverse.
That's road. Right. And as I say, I used to let them all see that I was cleaning my revolver. Maybe it's a silly thing, but, you know. And then I used to inspect the arms. And still, there's a check if anybody was sick. They paraded with the sergeant major, with the sergeant, and they went off to the see the battalion doctor. An American lad who's a doctor at Alain. Unfortunately, he was killed.
What was his name?
Oh, golly, no. It doesn't spring to mind. But an American killed at Alain. I think I'd only met him once. You know, on the day that I arrived up at battalion headquarters. Highly thought of, nice fella. And then having, you see, there was all sorts of, there's all sorts of jobs which we could do if necessary. We could, you know, I can't remember it ever happening, but you could even sit them all round in a circle and give a lesson on, you know, the politics of the day, or how to fire a Bren gun for the non-Bren gunners, or how to use a rifle and bayonet. You know, you could do all this. I'm not saying we did it.
Was it the intention, though, in the platoon that each man could do the other man's job?
Oh, yes.
From the point of view that everyone learned to bring
as far as you could. Yes. Yes. And there was always digging and strengthening your positioning as well.
Censoring letters, did that come into your work?
Not at Alamein. Not in that first sort of... yes, when I was in hospital. But... I certainly wrote letters from Maine, and they were collected and went up to battalion headquarters where undoubtedly somebody looked at them.
And mail was coming through to you, all right, was it?
No, not to me. he said, I'd moved very quickly from the moment I was commissioned, and I was in Alamein, you know, almost quicker than the boat could take me out. That sort of period of my history was chopping and changing all the way. Well, it went on doing it, you know, which happens, you see.
Did you have to assess the supply situation within your own platoon to make sure that you had everything of the right order and so on?
Constantly. And, of course, when there was a battle coming forward, you were helped do that, as it were, because you had to report that this was okay, you know, that you had enough. Everybody had his weapons; they were all functioning. He had his entrenching tools, and he had sandbags that had been issued to him, and you know, you had to do that as part of the. Breathing, you know. And just obviously, in a static position like that, there's no query about seeing that the men were fed and that, because, again, it was a service that happened to you. They could do it. It was an organization, and we had a very good one. And the quartermaster, you know, got up, it was a point of honor with him, getting his hot meals up to us in an edible condition. But you generally had to be alert on how the blokes were reacting to the living conditions. I never heard anybody saying he was bored, but then, you know, there was always the warning order on you that things were going to happen. Low-flying aircraft came over one day. And my God, if the Germans knew the chaos that created, because everybody just fires from where they are, you see, in somewhere in a hole. And I was just coming out of the company commander's tent as it went over, and it was so low that, you know, people were firing, you could hear the bullets whizzing past you. So I went back in the tent, it was gone, but, you know, little things to do.
Were you called to officers' group meetings, O groups?
Yes, not many. In fairness, it was an O group. I mean, usually it was a daily chat over what you were going to be involved in that day, as opposed to an O group where you'd been given orders for some sort of battle or an attack or whatever. We were in sort of, obviously, in constant contact with
news would be coming through to you. Did they keep you up to date with the progress of the war elsewhere?
Yes, we were a bit. What's the word when you think of only yourself? It's selfish in that we weren't sort of too interested in what was happening to the 14th Army, but what was happening to us was the important. Yes, if we'd had a, not that it happened in the time I'm talking, but if one of our ships had, you know, actually got a nice big ship, or the first 1,000 bomber raid, or something really dramatic, that came through to us, and cheered up. But the thing that I was particularly wanting was mail from home, which the cycle of whatever mail has to do to get to you hadn't caught up with me. Didn't catch up to me with the middle of the second month in. I was in hospital. And then I got about 50 letters all at once.
And the importance of mail to the soldier, which you just said, was...
Incredible. Incredible. And indeed, I used to be terrified of the poor souls who didn't get any, you know. Because mail up was the cry, and of course there was the bloke with the letters, and he used to read the name out, pass it over. You just chuck it over, you know. And then the blokes with the letters went off to his little corner to read it. And there's the crowd standing, and, you know, there was a time when I used to go around and try and have a chat, you know, just to let them know that I wasn't getting any letters as well, you know.
Did you feel this helped?
Well, I hoped it did, and it seemed to. But you know, you could come across tragic stories, you know, where he'd got a letter 2 months ago and he felt that she was playing away from home and, you know, and then nothing. And once or twice I had to speak to the padre about things to see if he could...
Did you get visits regularly from the padre? Did you come round the precisions?
Well, we had a marvellous padre, and he gave one service to which I attended. I was always a good Christian when we were going to get shot at, you know. Which I suppose wasn't the way to do things, but it was something you could put in your letter to your mother, couldn't you? Still go to church. But in hospital and about the battalion headquarters and that, and other units, listening to a fair cross section of the blokes in various positions I was in, the padre was a very important bloke, and they usually were first class men.
Was there opportunity for a regular service on, a Sunday?
Well,
where you were,
not in the Alamein line as such, no. But you know, forgetting about fixed positions, if your unit was travelling somewhere, it could well on a Sunday be a church service.
Were there other? How were the other denominations represented in the battalion? Or the
well, in the brigade, we usually had a C of E man and an RC man, sort of in another battalion, and some nonconformists or whatever you call them. We used to call them the odds and sods, you know. Their man would be about. So that there was always. All religions were catered for, as far as they could be catered for. And and it was never sort of. I was never very conscious of being chased about religion, but there was. He was there.
Having a number of South Wales people, you must have had a number of non-conformists.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, they would... the theory was, say, we were the C of E vicar, the non-conformists was the 6th Battalion. Well, the arrangement was that he was told about his flock that I had or we had in the 9th, and he made arrangements to come and see them. Not frequently, as in when the opportunity arose. And it might only be a walk amongst you sort of visit, you know.
But he was involved, as you say, if you had a man who was having problems at yourself.
Yes, you could.
He was like a social worker, was he?
Yes, he could do that. Yes. I made use of him once or twice. But whether I was never there long enough to find out what happened, you see, the usual story.